Hello, and welcome to GoonPod. Coming to you this week, live from a well-appointed ski lodge in the Italian Alps, where my guest and I are drinking cognac and contemplating forming a conga line. And we're both in sensible knitwear. Isn't that right, Gary?
Very much so, yes. And, oh, who is this who's just walked in? This is handsome American.
It's Robert Wagner.
Hey.
And who's that over there enjoying a joke with Capucine?
It's one and only Colin Gordon.
The dulcet tones you can hear belong to my guest this week, Gary Roger. Hello, Gary.
Hello, how are you doing? And thank you for inviting me back. I'm glad to say that I do have an actual working microphone this time, which is quite often useful when you're recording podcasts.
I had a hell of a job trying to... Because last time you were here, because Gary was on last year talking about the Clouseau films in general terms, and obviously I invited you on today to talk specifically about The Pink Panther, the first one, because it is 60 years this month, December 2023. In December 1963, The Pink Panther was released. But yeah, last time you were on, that the technology was letting you down slightly, so...
Well, what happened was I was actually speaking to you from Scotland last time.
Oh, yeah.
And that in itself shouldn't make a difference, but I was not speaking to you from my regular abode, and I had to make urgent provision for a microphone, and I chose one on the strength of the fine reviews on Amazon, which turned out to be less than accurate. But thankfully, I am now reunited with my lovely Blue Yeti, and yes, all is well. We don't need microphones here, do we? Because we're, as you said, we're in this lovely ski lodge, and
yes, of course.
You know, this is the home of yodeling, isn't it? And so your voice carries. And out there, I think I can see, is it Laurel and Hardy trying to move an organ over a rather wonky bridge and being chased by a gorilla? Yes, it is.
Is it Robert Wagner in a gorilla suit?
Now, have we actually now got a definitive link between Laurel and Hardy and the Pink Panther? Are we actually saying that's canon?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Yeah, we'll go with that. I'm sure I mentioned that last time I was on about Spike Milligan using that clip in There's a Lot of It About, with the added caption "Live from Oslo," which sent 9-year-old me into hysterics.
So, we're going to talk about gorilla suits a bit later, I think.
Yes, indeed.
So yeah, you're very fond of the franchise, aren't you? The Pink Panther franchise.
Yes.
The series of films with, let's face it, with Sellers as Clouseau.
Indeed. I mean, we have actually, we did watch, was about a year ago, we watched Inspector Clouseau with Alan Arkin.
Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting film, and he brought his own style to it. But I think also, I mean, that film, neither Peter Sellers nor Blake Edwards was involved in that film, am I right?
No, and I prefer my Alan Arkin, late 60s Alan Arkin, menacing Audrey Hepburn, than being a bumbling French detective, to be honest.
Yeah, funny you mentioned Audrey Hepburn, because I think her name's going to come up in this conversation.
So everything's linked.
It is, isn't it? It really is. I mean, this is, I know that this is something that you and I and Tilt, of course, have talked about on the Sitcom Club before, about the supposed sitcom universe, where basically everything is just an expansion of everything else. And we've probably advanced this absurd notion that when television started in Britain, it should have been an established protocol that every piece of... Okay, we'll give Shakespeare, you know, a pass on this. Mm. But any kind of new drama or comedy, all of it has to be in some way linked to the previous one.
Yeah.
So that you have this enormous, basically vast stellar street of fictitious characters running all the way through every single piece of British drama and comedy.
You mentioned the Sitcom Club there. So that is that, along with Jaffa Cakes for Proust, are the two central planks of your podcasting empire, shall we say. Both of which have been on hiatus for quite some time for a number of reasons.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, we are hopeful, but we can't guarantee it, but we are hopeful that we might be able to release some sort of Christmassy treat before the end of the year. But in the meantime, all of the previous episodes are available, of course, at sitcomclub.com.
Yeah.
And thank you for giving me the chance to crowbar that in there.
And the possible Christmas treat, it's possibly about a hitherto, to us anyway, unknown sitcom from the 1970s. Is that right?
Well, now this is the thing, because you actually put me onto this, because I'm trying to remember what I was doing. I think I was probably faffing about... Oh, I know what it was. Yes, oh... Oh, right, okay. How much of this can I say out loud? Okay. So my real life work, so to speak, is at ITV. And I was doing some ITV bits and pieces one evening. I think it might have been involving the FA Cup or something like that. And I suddenly get an urgent message from Tyler saying, there's a sitcom with Ken Jones and Arthur Lowe together. Can you get this thing? And yeah, we investigated it. And yes, it turns out that a few of them have managed to survive. Mm. So yeah, we will come back to that. Hopefully that'll be before the end of the year. But yes, I'm looking forward to that. I know we watched the first one of those just recently. And it's good, silly fun by the same writer as... Nearest and Dearest, John Stevenson.
Yeah, and what else? He wrote Coronation Street. Not all of it.
He did.
A number of episodes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully, as I say, that will be coming up sometime in the future. So let's talk about the Pink Panther.
We must find that woman. What was that? What did you say?
We don't have much of a description. About 5'7". Black hair, wearing a light beige coat.
And the fools let that fence escape. He might have talked.
We will catch him.
We must. We must find that woman. She is our first positive link with the Phantom.
This film in particular, what does it mean to you?
So, I suppose like most youths, I got into Pink Panthering via the cartoons. And my era was very much the all-new Pink Panther show featuring Crazy Legs Crane.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, gradually through repeats and what have you, you're introduced to the others in the series, particularly the fact that the Inspector Clouseau cartoons, he has a sidekick who sounds very much like he's voiced by John Bluthal, although I don't think he is. Mm-hmm. He never actually appears in the films.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I think maybe the first one I ever saw was Strikes Again. I think it would have been a television screening of that sometime around about early 80s. And for a while, that was how I just saw the Pink Panther films. It is Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau, and there's Cato running around, and there's Herbert Lom with his dangerous cigar lighter, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And gradually... One of our reference guides, because of course, you know, these days it's all about the internets, isn't it? It's all about the TikToks.
Yeah.
But when you and I were growing up, you had books on a shelf that were written by people like Leslie Halliwell.
Mm-hmm.
And you consulted them if you wanted to find out about past films of a series. And that's when I discovered, of course, about the fact that David Niven had been in the original Pink Panther and this was intended as a vehicle for himself. And I don't actually think I saw this film until the year 2000, surprisingly enough. Because for whatever reason, my viewing of the Pink Panther films was somewhat sporadic. So I never saw Revenge of the Pink Panther until I think 1992. I saw the Alan Arkin one, strangely enough. I think I saw that before then. I think that was sitting there in the video shop and I was intrigued to find out what it looked like.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure I know. I certainly saw the trail of the Pink Panther many years before I ever saw the actual Pink Panther. So
what about Shot in the Dark? When did you see that?
Shot in the Dark, I don't think I saw that for the first time until maybe about 10 years ago. Strangely enough, that one had always eluded me.
Okay.
I, for whatever reason, you know what it's like with like certain films or shows where you always just realise that you've just missed them in the schedule. They were just on the other day or something like that. And before, you know, obviously we had catch up and so on. So it was one of those things where it was like always, oh, next time it's on, I'll get to see it.
Yeah.
But I got Trail of the Pink Panther out of the video shop, I think, sometime around about 91, 92.
God help you.
And, of course, Trail has quite a lot of clips of the Pink Panther in it. So that would have been the first time that I'd seen that footage. And then the first time I actually saw the film was a television airing in 2000.
Was that the notorious ITV airing?
Yes. I mean, I don't know that it has a lot of notoriety outside of our conversations.
Yeah.
Well. But for anybody who didn't hear us discussing this previously, it got an airing at early peak time, Saturday tea time, in August of 2000, and was intended to then kick off a Pink Panther season with the rest of the films in that same slot. But that season didn't get any further, at least in that slot. It then moved to early afternoon. And we were chatting off air the other day about it may well be that people who were planning those schedules at the time were sort of thinking, well, obviously you're going to start with the first one, whereas the audience is expecting to see Broad, Inspector Clouseau, and Cato, and Dreyfus, and so on, so on. And I suspect, to be honest, I think it would have been exactly the same if they had started the season with A Shot in the Dark. I mean, even though you've got, by that point, yes, you've got Dreyfus and so on, I think that for most people, The Return, Strikes Again, and Revenge are considered the epitome of Clouseau. That they're what, generally speaking, what people identify with when they think of that character. And as we'll discuss, this film is somewhat uneven, and there is a sort of a back and forth between Sellers and Niven as to who this film is for, in a way.
Well, yeah, so the film was conceived as a comedy, well, like a gentle comedy, not a gentle comedy, but one of those glitzy international romps that was so beloved of filmmakers in the early 60s. About this charming jewel thief, Sir Charles Lytton, aka the Phantom. And I gather that Niven saw this, or hoped that this would be the first of a series of you know, films about the antics of Sir Charles Lytton, because he was casting around for projects to work on around this time, wasn't he? And the character of Clouseau was very much secondary. And Peter Ustinov was famously originally cast as Clouseau.
I didn't actually realise until I was researching for the podcast today that Ustinov apparently, well, this is according to Blake Edwards in an interview, he had pulled out of the film with 1 week to go.
Yeah, something and, like that. Yeah.
Yes, and so they were in quite a desperate state to try and find a replacement.
See, and these days you'd be held to a contract, surely to God, that you'd be, financially, it would be very, very difficult to extricate yourself from
I think they actually said that they did pursue legal action against Ustinov as a result of him pulling out. And he wasn't the first person, of course, as we'll come to have left the project.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so he went off and filmed a very good film, Top Carpi, which was directed by Jules Dassin. Have you seen Top? I probably asked you this last time. Have you seen Top Carpi? Have we watched it?
I have
it,
not.
No.
No, I have. No, we have not. We'll have to put that on the list.
It's really good. It's based on an Eric Ambler. I love Eric Ambler, the novelist. It's based on one of his novels. And apparently Sellers had been offered the role that Ustinov took up. So essentially they swap roles, I guess.
Ceramics handmade by the descendants of ancient heroes here. Reverend. My name is Simpson, sir. Arthur Simpson. I'm Church of England myself.
It's a very religious place. Do you know that St. Paul passed through here on his way to Samothrace?
I do.
Well, you'd be surprised to know the amount of people that don't. Bishop.
The whole idea of the Pink Panther came about because Blake Edwards was talking to a writer that he had used before, a writer called Maurice Richelin. Yes. And he approached him with a pitch for a film. It was basically a French police inspector is on the trail of a notorious jewel thief. And the twist is that the inspector's wife is having an affair with the thief. And that was the pitch, and Blake Edwards ran with it.
We may as well actually just touch on that straight away, because I asked yourself last night about this, and then we said, save it for the recording.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Otherwise, we'll have to discuss everything beforehand. So, okay, let's take opposing views on this for the sake of argument. Okay, let's suggest that this is Sky News, and today's hot topic during Kay Burley's show is this. Did Clouseau and Simone, did they actually have a loving relationship at first before her head was turned by the world of Yves Saint Laurent? Or was Simone always in a relationship with Sir Charles and was using Clouseau from day one? You can take whatever side of the argument you want, and I'll provide the counterpoint.
So how long, in the film, Clouseau says that he's been on the trail of the Phantom for, I think it's, I didn't jot it down, between 10 and 15 years, something like that, I think. Mm. And I think he's only been married to Simone less than that period. So I contend that Simone married Clouseau specifically to aid the Phantom. In other words, she would be able to provide the Phantom with inside information. And so he'd be one step ahead of the police investigations. That's my contention.
Okay, for the sake of argument, I'm going to say I would like to think, and I'm more sort of, this is out of sympathy for Clouseau, I'd like to think that there was something there to begin with before. Because, I mean, okay, if given that Clouseau has been chasing the Phantom for so long, then he's bound to have mentioned it early on in their relationship.
Mm.
And the more he said about the Phantom, perhaps that's when she started getting interested. And
perhaps
has then sort of considered, okay, well, you know, this Phantom is oh, yeah, because obviously he suspects, doesn't he? You know, before the Pink Panther itself is his latest target, that he suspects it is Sir Charles. So she will have seen Sir Charles as an important person, a businessman, so on and so on in the media, and thought, yeah, that lifestyle looks interesting compared to the lifestyle of a police officer's wife. So,
but yeah, technically then she has unmasked Sir Charles as the Phantom before her husband has, and that's his job.
Well, I mean, we know that Sir Charles and Simone are already in a relationship at the beginning of this film.
Hmm.
So maybe it's Sir Charles himself who has unmasked himself to Simone rather than Clouseau, perhaps.
And the rest.
Hmm. Well, indeed, yes. But, I mean, because, yeah, at first glance, you're sort of thinking, okay, yeah, how Clouseau and Simone, their worlds are not the same. And you think, yeah, how could this have come about? But it could be true love.
But again,
could it, initially,
she's an elegant, self-assured woman of the world, and it's like the question: how did Clouseau get to the position he is in the French, in the Sûreté?
Now, yes, because I'm going to suggest that this is a Peter principle in play. And that Clouseau is, strange thing is, okay, Clouseau is buffoonish and he's obviously accident prone, but I don't think Clouseau is stupid. Clouseau sometimes in his calculations and what have you, I'm going beyond just this one single film and thinking of the series as a whole. Sometimes he's right. Sometimes he is correct in his calculations. He's not very good at being able to act upon his suspicions, but he must surely have... Okay, it sounds ridiculous saying this. When you then think of the scene with himself and John Blufall as the lookout at the beginning of Return, and you think, how on earth could this... How does this guy actually manage to, you know, find his way to the office correctly every morning? But... I think there was a combination of, he does have a good brain for detective work to an extent. I think he's also got good people around him, and also he is quite often lucky that he finds himself at the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. And I could see that happening, because I mean, everybody knows people like that, probably in their own workplace. You see people and you think, oh, the bloody hell did they get promoted to that
absolutely.
Level? And yeah. Okay, I'm
one of them.
Right, okay, hang on. Okay, I'm gonna be circumspect about what I'm describing here.
Okay.
But this is a place that I used to work at many, many years ago, like sort of 20 plus years ago. One of the managers there was receiving an award for, I don't know, whatever it was, employee of the month, whatever it was. It was some dude that were staging. And up he goes, and he gets his little plaque and what have you, and shakes the chief executive's hand. And there's a woman there that I didn't recognise, because we're all standing at the bar, myself and all these co-workers. And she's saying, how the hell he got that, I will never know. If he is your manager, then God help a lot of you. That was his wife. And honestly, I mean, and she wasn't wrong, because if you ever said anything to him, like if you said you've got some sort of issue and you explained what the problem was, his face would just freeze, like mm-hmm. he was like the equivalent of like the blue screen on Windows. You could see that, like the cogs trying to turn over in his mind. Mm-hmm. But somehow he was above, far more on the face of it, far more capable people, and he obviously said the right things. He never struck me either as a particularly good networker. So how he done it, I don't know. But yeah, so I can only assume that the same as
but sometimes, Gary, it's something as simple as, I used to work for a very small company many, many, many years ago, where someone completely incompetent in terms of doing the actual job achieved a level of promotion simply because he provided our boss with a steady stream of pornography. So back in the days when you had to work for it, you know. It's interesting, just talking about, you said Clouseau's not stupid, or at least I think it's quite interesting watching this film again for the purposes of this, because you're watching it, I'm watching it with more of a critical eye, you know. And it's interesting how Clouseau frequently acknowledges when something simple that he attempts to do goes awry.
There's one in particular where he is in the bedroom and he attempts to place his gloves and his hat on the hanger, and both just immediately drop to the floor, and he just holds up his hands.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to say a word. And
He's not oblivious to his failings, is he? Let's put it that way.
Yes.
And I like, it's interesting as well. So we're going to go backwards and forwards with this conversation, I know, but you said before that Sellers was the replacement for Ustinov at very short notice. And I gather, depending on, you know, what you've read, who you believe, Sellers arrived in Rome on the Friday to begin filming on the Monday in November 62. Mm-hmm. And he meets Blake Edwards. Blake Edwards really only knew him from seeing I'm All Right, Jack, prior to this.
Yes.
And in the car journey from the airport to the hotel, the two of them were talking about the character of Clouseau as it had been sketched out for Ustinov. And the Ustinov Clouseau was to be quite composed, quite straight, quite by the book. And Sellers was firm that he wanted to make the role his own. So both men, you mentioned Laurel and Hardy, both men loved Laurel and Hardy. They loved the great silent comics. And in that, during the course of that car journey, between the two of them, they sort of shaped the character of Clouseau, the basic details, if you like. So he's a well-intentioned, yet idiotic, accident-prone character who is aware of his own failings but never gives up despite everything conspiring against him. And he always tries to maintain his dignity.
Yes.
Above all else.
Yes.
And also in this film, this first film, we never see, because he's only got a wife in this film. In subsequent films, he's a bachelor. He's very, what's the word? Uxorious. He's very devoted, overly devoted to his wife. Mm. Although I think he's just trying to get his end away, really, isn't he? Let's face it.
Uh-huh. Why aren't you in bed, my darling?
I'm just going, dear. Oh, Uncle.
My Stradivarius.
Yes, the porter just brought it in.
Oh, I sent it to the village to be repaired. I just hope they know how to fix plastic.
I hope so, too.
So far, so good. We shall see. Better than ever. Dear, I doubt if we shall need it tonight, my love.
I'm sure we won't, darling.
Yeah, no, he really does come across as genuinely in love with someone.
Yeah.
And that makes it all the more tragic.
Yeah.
Because you can see that he's being played. And I suspect that anybody else observing their relationship for any length of time, even if they don't know anything about Sir Charles being in the picture, they can see that it's generally one-way traffic. Mm-hmm. You know, he will give a lot, she will give a little back, which seems to be just enough to satisfy him and to keep him, you know, away from suspicion or whatever. Because there are a couple of times in the film where he says at one point, we mustn't have any secrets between us. And he spots little things like, well, not little things at all, but like the shattered vase of flowers and so on. And even then, there's a little flicker there as if he's sort of thinking, okay, is there something going on here? But that doesn't last very long. That doesn't stay with him. He doesn't become more and more suspicious. He's almost like he's constantly on his guard every once in a while. But then she only has to say the slightest little thing and he's reassured again. And as far as he's concerned, all is okay.
There's this scene where he sees the wet footprints.
Yes.
Trailing along the floor towards the bed.
Yes.
And he's, for the longest time, he's trying to work out what this could mean. And then Simone just pulls him into the bed and all is forgotten.
Yes.
Pretty much. It is. I mean, a lot of this film is set in the Clouseau bedroom, or the hotel bedroom that the Clouseaus are staying in, and it's a classic bedroom farce, isn't it?
Well, no. This is the one of the things that struck me about the film and how sort of uneven it is, because in a way it sort of feels like two films. I don't just mean that the to and fro in between is Sir Charles or Clouseau, which one of them is actually like the big star of this film, but you see that, like, the first thing that actually struck me just watching it back the other day, the opening titles don't include Clouseau, which is understandable because, like you say, he wasn't intended to be the principal character. The next thing I noticed, apart from the fact of how colourful the film is, because it makes good use of the outdoors and the surroundings and everything, it looks so warm, it looks so inviting.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but in the first 10 minutes of the film, we see four different locations, and they are on location. Right at the beginning, we see the Sultan of Lugash, don't we? Mm-hmm. But then we see Rome, including apartments which were situated directly across the road from the Colosseum, Hollywood, and Cortina.
Yes.
That's all in the first 10 minutes.
Yes. And then you go from that, and it's a really busy opening as well. There's a lot going on in those first few minutes, and a lot of characters going on. And there's also a couple of, they're not red headings as such, but a couple of things that sort of throw you the wrong way. The two heavies that are chasing after Robert Wagner's character, for example, you might think, okay, well, we're going to see them again. We never do. Things like that, where you're just sort of finding your way in the opening of the film. You're sort of thinking, okay, right, who's who here? What's our focus point?
I expected more, definitely, from the Robert Wagner character in terms of his backstory to come into this. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really. All it is that he owes some goons in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
$40,000.
Yeah.
He's been lying to his benefactor, his uncle.
Yeah.
Sir Charles, that he's studious at college and looking to join the Peace Corps. But he's just been out and about having a grand old time of it, hasn't he? Really?
Yes.
And
he's an early American prototype for Leslie Phillips in Casanova 73.
You better explain that.
So for those who've never seen Casanova 73, written by Gotland Simpson, is basically Leslie Phillips trying to get his oats week in and week out. And this show began at 8 o'clock in the evening and was rapidly elbowed to post-Watershed because it really was just Leslie Phillips trying to get his leg over.
With a very suggestive opening credit sequence.
Oh, God, yes. Yes.
And which we won't dwell on, but
no.
wasn't it responsible for Mastermind?
Yes, because they needed something to go into that 8 o'clock slot, and Mastermind it was, and of course that then became. I mean, it's still going today, of course, but yeah, that promotion to that slot is what established Mastermind from then on.
Should we just talk a little bit about the principal actors in this?
Yes.
I always like to do this. I like to say, what have we seen them in before and that sort of thing. Now,
let me just quickly throw in one name right at the outset.
Go on.
Which name popped up on the screen, and I thought, I know that name, but I cannot place him. The associate producer of the film was Dick Crockett. And I think he might also have been stuntman for this film as well.
He was, yes.
He was the president in Strikes Again.
The sort of Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford type guy, yes.
Avatar. Really?
Yes, oh, wow. I knew. As soon as I saw his name, I thought, I've seen that name somewhere before.
Ah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, because the scenes in the Pink Panther during the fancy dress party, you've obviously got Clouseau in the suit of armour, and sometimes the visor is up, sometimes it's down. And often when it's down, the character of Clouseau falls over.
Yes.
That's Dick Crockett in that. It's not Sellers.
I do like the fact that Clouseau, again, this goes back to him not having an excess of common sense, that of all the different costumes that he could have chosen for this rather important task, he has chosen the least mobile of all.
You're not going to outrun somebody, are you, in a suit of armor?
Do we think that he went to the dress shop of Augustus Balls, regardless of whether he was Graham Stark or Harvey Korman, and they said, I have just the thing for you, Inspector.
Did August Balls have a branch in Rome?
I'm sure something could be arranged. I mean, I think he is actually his only customer, is he not?
Yeah. Okay, but yes, so that's interesting. Dick Crockett, yeah. I can picture him now in Strikes Again. Which is that your favourite? Is that your favourite Panther film?
My favourite of all is Return, because I think that it's just got the perfect balance of the Clouseau. By that time, Clouseau is sort of what you've come to expect from him. The character is fully rounded, and he's in, I suppose, what you call his final form. I really like the subplot with Christopher Plummer. Running through that film as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that Niven didn't return to play Sir Charles. It's Christopher Plummer. Yet Niven returns after Sellers is dead for Trail and for Curse.
Yes, he is in Curse as well. Yes, yeah. as is Capucine.
Yeah.
But I don't think Niven would have been right for the role as portrayed in Return, because he's much more physical. He seems to have gone backwards in age. He's a slightly younger man.
True.
And there's a lot of action going on. I don't know that Niven would have been ideal for that.
Probably not. No. Just on Capucine, real name, I'm going to have to take a run at this. Germaine Helene Irene Lefebvre. he was famous as a model. But she did quite a few films. And her squeeze at the time of this film, for want of a better word, was Charles Feldman. Mm-hmm. And he also happened to be Blake Edwards' agent. Uh-huh. And she came into, because I think Ava Gardner was meant to be Madame Clouseau, wasn't she?
Yes.
But she had some unrealistic demands.
Yes, and I think she ended up leaving maybe about sort of 3 weeks into the initial stages of the production. Mm-hmm. And it was about a week after that, I think, that Ustinov left.
But Capucine, interesting, because she had a long relationship with the actor William Holden. Mm-hmm. in the 60s. She was very close friends with Audrey Hepburn. And Audrey Hepburn had been considered for the role of the princess.
Yes.
Hadn't she?
Yes.
And I think you said, because we touched on this last night, I think you said, or Tilt said, that would have made sense. And mm-hmm. I disagree.
Yes. Yeah.
Because right at the beginning of the film, when we see the young princess in the pre-credit sequence in Lugash, mm-hmm. clearly played by a young actress who is, you know, of Asian descent, no getting around it, mm-hmm. whereas Claudia Cardinale, who we see, you know, in the rest of the film as the actual grown-up princess, Princess Darla, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, at the very best, you could say she's got swarthy looks, swarthy Mediterranean looks. Mm-hmm. She's basically changed race as she's grown up.
I mean, had it been Audrey Hepburn, I mean, okay, it certainly wasn't uncommon for people to be playing characters of different ethnicities to themselves.
Oh, no. No one had that.
So, yeah. Well, Sellers himself, of course. Mm. So, yeah. But I think that Claudia Cardinale is ideal for that role, to be honest. I think she comes across quite natural in the role, whereas I think that Audrey Hepburn might have been a bit sort of film star. Does that make sense, the way I'm saying that? It's like, oh, bloody hell, it's Audrey Hepburn. And the whole time you're looking at her, you're thinking it's Audrey Hepburn.
Yes.
Whereas the role of the princess is to be somewhat understated, and she's also extremely cautious about Sir Charles and the other people around her, because as we discover in the subplot, it's not just the fact that she's got this very valuable diamond, but also there is a political slant to it as well. It's disputed. And we're having this conversation when the top story in the news today is about the Elgin Marbles.
Oh God, yeah. she's portrayed as very vulnerable, but at the same time very strong-willed and mm-hmm. very self-confident.
Yes.
She's got agency in this film, and yeah. And what I couldn't get my head around was that, because it was a marvelous job they did, she was overdubbed for the whole film.
Yes,
I didn't know whether it wasn't that she couldn't speak English properly, or she had such a heavy accent that they needed to overdub her for the whole film. I'm not quite sure.
I was 3 years old when I rode my first elephant. I was 6 when I went on my first safari. Frasari. Wild animal hunt. And I was 10 when I bagged my first tiger. But I'll never forget my lovely little pony.
When did you bag him?
Oh, you're making fun again. You really don't like animals. Don't trust a man who doesn't care about animals. And don't trust an animal who doesn't care about people. Why you don't like people?
I like people.
Oh. That's supposed to be me who doesn't like people. Right?
If you say so.
No, I should just point it out, by the way.
Yeah.
Best instance of somebody being dubbed for a film. Harry Hernia in Carry On Emmanuel, dubbed by Kenneth Connor as an Australian.
What?
So there was a bodybuilder called Harry Hernia.
Yes.
And the guy, the bodybuilder himself playing the role, was thought to have quite a sort of weak voice. not really a strongman voice, so he's dubbed by Kenneth Connor, who then plays him as an Australian.
But Kenneth Connor's in the film as well as...
Yes, he is, but he's not playing an Australian, so he's able to do both voices. Right. Yeah. And you're going to see the actor who plays Harry Hernia in another film at some point. When we get round to discussing Come Play With Me.
Oh, dear God. Yeah, okay.
Which you really should not have agreed to.
Well, I want to see it for the reasons that you've really built it up over the years that we've talked about Come Play With Me.
I think in all honesty, I think it's... This is off topic. But I think it has developed mystique all of its own. But yeah, we'll save that for the cast.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Now, Capucine, she's got really good comedy chops in this. Mm-hmm. Good timing. She works very well. She plays off Sellers very well. The bit with the hat, when the hat drops in her face, caught in the hairpin. She's not afraid to do comedy, which a lot of models turned actresses would possibly feel a bit awkward or disinclined to do the comedy, mm-hmm. I would have said. But... I thought she was very good. She was in lots of French movies. She was in What's New Pussycat, of course, which Sellers was in. And she also, she was in Trail and Curse of the Pink Panther.
Mm-hmm.
She was in an episode of Heart to Heart alongside Robert Wagner.
Yep.
And she was to have been cast in the Sellers film Waltz of the Toreadors, but this fell through. And David Niven. What do you think of David Niven generally?
Well, I mean, David Niven is not somebody that I've actually seen a lot of on screen. I've not seen a lot of his work. But, of course, I was familiar with him growing up, and I think I was probably more aware of just his general sort of persona and being the typical, as portrayed, English gentleman.
Mm.
And he's somebody that I'm interested to see in more films. I would like to see him in Raffles. I think maybe 1939, I think that was. Be interested to see him in that. And there's also one that we've spoken about as well. There is a bank robbery film. I think it's called, is that A Nightingale in Berkeley Square?
A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, yeah.
Mm. Yes, yeah. I'm interested to see that as well. Yeah. And I've not really heard him being spoken about in a great deal in terms of acting range. I think that he's more somebody who is very dependable on screen and was a big name for the fact that he personified a particular type of gentleman. And of course, he's ideal in this. I think that perhaps the scenes where he is attempting to seduce the princess, perhaps the age gap is a bit too much.
Yeah.
For sort of modern audiences. But then the princess herself actually refers to that in the conversation around the dining table, the fact that he's a middle-aged man going from one conquest to another.
Mm-hmm. He tends to always play the same sort of character, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Really. I'm very fond of him I'm very fond of the film in general, A Matter of Life and Death. The Power and Pressburger film.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Again, he was the lead character in Casino Royale? Lead actor in Casino Royale?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was in Murder by Death with Sellers as well, of course. And, yes. Great raconteur. And he was just never off Parkinson, was he? He was always on Parkinson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And his character in this, Sir Charles, the relationship that he has with the princess is never made clear. Is he purely just trying? Do you think he has any romantic interest in her at all, or is he purely just trying to get the goods in terms of where the diamond is?
Through getting drunk and whatnot. I think romantically, no, but in terms of trying to have his evil way, so to speak. Certainly.
Yeah.
And if that then, by extension, then leads him closer to the diamond, then all the better.
Yeah. I'm going to talk more about the cast, of course, but just, we might as well talk about this bit now. But so in this film, I would say 60% of Clouseau in this film, he's desperate to have adult hugs with his wife.
Yes.
If you know
yes.
what I mean.
Yeah.
And his poor thwarted libido. He's a bit like, he reminds me a bit of Pepe Le Pew in this.
there's one scene that, do you know what, it sounds strange, because as I was watching it, I thought, did I actually hear that, or am I just sort of wishing that I'd heard it because it's such a good gag? And then when I was going through some newspaper cuttings for reviews of the film from the time itself, I was so pleased to actually see one reviewer specifically mention this, so I knew that I hadn't imagined it at all. The point where Simone says, I think I'd best just have a sleeping pill and you better have one yourself, and he walks into the bathroom and then drops the sleeping pills, and you don't see it. And then later on, a few seconds later, he's trampling over them again, and again you don't see it. And I'm sort of thinking, did I hear that? Was that? Yeah. And that's just such a lovely idea for a gag, because it's a sight gag that isn't a sight gag.
And also key to it as well. I mean, so much of the comedy with Clouseau happens off camera. Mm-hmm. And in that instance, you don't hear him. You hear the sound of the sleeping pills dropping on the floor in the bathroom. You don't hear Sellers going, oh shit, or something, yes, or whatever. Yeah, and yeah. He walks out perfectly passive face, passive expression. You know, he's used to this sort of thing happening in his life. And Blake Edwards was, you know, made a point of filming, as I say, lots of the comedy occurring off camera. He was influenced by Ernst Lubitsch, the German film director of Heaven Can Wait, and we saw it recently, didn't we? To Be or Not to Be.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the actors move more than the camera.
I think I'll just take a sleeping pill.
Very well, my darling, I'll get it for you.
And why don't you take one yourself? You need the rest, you know.
Yes, I think perhaps I will do.
Thank you, my angel.
You've got Sir Charles, what we would say today, you know, the problematic scenes potentially with Sir Charles and the much, much younger princess, and putting pressure on her to a degree, getting her drunk and all that sort of thing. You've got Robert Wagner's character, George, trying to force himself pretty much on Madame Clouseau and the princess, I think, at one point. And Clouseau himself, of course, who's just, you know, all he wants is a bit of loving, really. It's all he wants.
Yeah.
And Roger Lewis, in his book on Sellers, he said, the joke of The Pink Panther is that it is a sex comedy in which the characters don't get to have any. Claudia Cardinale's whorish princess, that's a bit strong. Come on, Roger. Claudia Cardinale's whorish princess gets drunk on champagne and passes out on Niven's Sir Charles. Capucine fends off Robert Wagner. Niven is always called away or otherwise distracted if Capucine comes close. Nobody succeeds in getting their rocks off. Nobody manages to keep possession of the rock, the Pink Panther jewel itself.
Hang on, was he actually, I mean, he surely wasn't expecting full-on Confessions of a Window Cleaner in 1963, was he? I mean, if there had actually been a scene involving two or more of those characters, would it have got past the censor? Probably not. Probably maybe Billy copies circulate in Scandinavia.
Right. Okay. We haven't mentioned them really, have we? And I think we need to. The wonderful, peerless Colin Gordon.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And of course, the role of sort of Clouseau's sidekick to an extent, that goes to Graham Stark in Shot in the Dark.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have, remind me of his name, your man from Return and Strikes Again and Revenge, Andre.
Andre Moran.
Yes. But for this film, we have Colin Gordon as the Lloyds of London representative.
Yep.
And he's one of those actors who was just in everything. Another one of those faces that you just like, you know, all the people we've spoken about before, like Frank Thornton and so on. If it's a British film of a certain era, Colin Gordon is going to be in it. And the first time I would have ever seen Colin Gordon was in Steptoe and Son.
Yeah.
When he's playing the representative of the DHSS and slowly getting plastered. And we saw him in a very different role. A drama involving two bank robbers.
Oh, Strong Room.
Yes.
Darren Nesbitt. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, he's playing against, well, I always think of Colin Gordon, he's a sitcom stalwart, and he tends to play minor members of sort of middle management or officialdom. Whereas in that, he's a bank manager, sure, but he shows a very sort of human, caring side, doesn't he? Because, Well, I won't ruin it, but yeah. And of course, we've been watching him very recently, in the Complete and Utter History of Britain.
It's really nice, actually, that he is in the publicity material that I've seen for the show, which was recovered and restored by the wonderful people at ITV.
Oh, yes.
And for the publicity...
Are you contractually obliged to say that?
I am not, but no, they do a fabulous job. And I'm so pleased to see the show return and be celebrated as a result.
Yeah.
And when the initial publicity material came out for it, and you can see it on the streaming service, he's right there. He's front and center along with Palin and Jones. And he's ideal in that role. He's perfect as the guy holding it all together.
Yeah. He, of course, was number two in The Prisoner, famously.
Yes.
And I thought I was very clever last night, Gary, when we were talking about this. I said, do you know, Gary, there's two number twos in The Pink Panther, and you spent the longest time.
I'm thinking, okay, I don't remember seeing Leo McKern. Was Patrick Coggle wasn't in it? Just watched it. No, I definitely didn't see Darren Nesbitt. No, no way. So no, and you had me flummoxed.
Oh yeah. So I said, well, okay. Well, if you've seen the Austin Powers films, which thankfully I've only seen once, and not all of them either, you have a character who's like Dr. Evil's henchman, just known as Number Two, played by Robert Wagner.
Hey,
who? He's 93 and still working, I believe.
Well, we've been watching him recently, haven't we, in Cold It?
We have the wonderful, what was that, 72 BBC? Mm-hmm. 72 series? He's very much just one of the cast, though, isn't he? He's not a lead in that, necessarily.
He's actually got, I think he's got the headline credit on most of the episodes. But he sort of, apart from one episode that we've seen so far where he is the focal point, he's sort of like appearing sparingly.
Yeah. Do you think, if Robert Wagner had been taken out of this film, if his character wasn't in this film, would it have affected it in any way, do you think?
I don't really think so. I mean, we chatted about this briefly, and I was sort of hypothesized, and without any evidence to back this up, but I was thinking perhaps this was to maybe attract American audiences, having good-looking young man in the cast.
Yeah.
But I don't really think his character is adding a great deal to the text. I was thinking, actually, that because one of the things that I didn't pick up on it at first, but as I was then seeing the film play out again, you've got obviously the long scene with Charles and the princess after the dinner party. Then you've got him discovering his nephew is there for the first time. Then there's a scene with them skiing, and there's a scene with them at the train station. All of this is going on without clues on the screen.
Yeah.
And I can't really think of anything that's absolutely pivotal to the plot that needs his nephew there. Okay, aside from one, obviously the two gorillas.
Yeah, but they could have had Kepu seen in one of those gorillas.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I don't think that he was essential to. Do you know what? It's going to sound absurd. He's the kind of character who would have been, if this was a film based on a novel, he's the kind of character that would have been in the novel, and then by the time it's got to the big screen, his character has been dropped.
Absolutely.
Because there's just not enough time. And as it is, I think the film itself is a little bit longer than it needs to be.
It is
odd that you've got all of these scenic views, all this location work and so on, and you've got long, long stretches of the film that are just taking place in Clouseau's bedroom.
Yeah.
And suddenly, because one of the reviewers at the time actually described it as a Rick's like farce.
Mm.
And I mean, it's not inconceivable actually that you could have done this on the stage, because I'm right in thinking that A Shot in the Dark, I think, originally was
that was a French play, not called Shot in the Dark, called something else, and Clouseau was nothing to do with it. And because of the success of, because they realized very early on that, I mean, in this film, Sellers went into it as a supporting actor and emerged as the star, really, the standout. And so they realized very early on that they needed to capitalize on this and make another film. And so I think Blake Edwards had the rights to this play, and he just repurposed it to be a Clouseau vehicle, essentially. Clouseau in The Pink Panther, he's almost fully formed in terms of how we come to know him, isn't he? In terms of the look.
Yes.
But the accent isn't quite there. It's more of a straightforward French accent that he uses. And it's halfway through the filming of Shot in the Dark, which, by the way, is my favourite of these films. In fact, it's my favourite Sellers film of all time. Okay. Halfway through, Sellers decided to alter the voice. And so that's why in Shot in the Dark, sometimes in parts, you know, he's got a fairly straightforward, conventional French accent. And then there's other scenes where he refers to, for example, a myth, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, going back to that, saying Clouseau being almost fully formed, you know, he springs onto the screen almost as we would come to know him in later films. And it reminded me a little bit of Columbo. Because Columbo is first, with Peter Falk, it is first seen in a 1968 TV movie called Prescription Murder.
Mm-hmm.
And although he's slightly smarter, and he doesn't, I don't think he's got the shabby Mac at that point, and his hair's a bit shorter and a bit neater, but he's more or less, and he's maybe a little bit more gruff.
Yes.
But more or less, he's the Columbo that, you know, we come to know and love in the 70s and to a slightly lesser degree in the 90s. So it's quite amazing that there wasn't, you know, that there wasn't a huge amount of... Okay, so I suppose Clouseau in the later films becomes more cartoonish, doesn't he? Let's face it.
Yeah.
I suppose.
A couple of things, actually, that struck me about this early portrayal of Clouseau. I thought that the scene where you had Clouseau and Colin Gordon as
Tucker.
What's his character? Tucker.
Tucker.
Clouseau and Tucker visit the princess ahead of the big party. And that little scene with the three of them, that strikes me as probably the most Clouseau, as in later Clouseau,
yes,
scene of the whole film.
Yes.
Because we've finally got him away from his wife for 2 minutes. And here he is with a sensible sidekick as well. And that struck me as something that just would not at all have been out of place in any of the later films.
Your Highness, please excuse this interruption. I have news of great importance. This is Mr. Tucker of Lloyd's of London, and we have met before.
I've met her too, you know.
Yes, I know, but we are meeting her again now.
What is this news?
Your Highness, I have discovered the identity of the Phantom.
You don't say.
I do say.
Well, of course, you're not positive.
I am positive. He is, I believe, at this very moment here in Rome.
Really?
Yes. Have you seen or heard from Sir Charles Lytton?
Not since I left Cortina. Why?
Sir Charles and the Phantom are one and the same.
You're not serious.
I am serious. I can understand how difficult it is for your Highness to accept the facts. Sir Charles is a very persuasive and attractive man.
He is also Sir Charles Lytton, a man of considerable influence and reputation.
She's got quite a point there, you know.
He is a fraud and I shall prove it.
You know that he's going to trip over that step.
Mm-hmm.
But he keeps it going for so long. And eventually you start to doubt yourself and you think, well, maybe he isn't actually. And of course he does.
Yeah.
But also he's not going face first. It's just, it's subtle. It's very, you know, carefully done. Something that struck me, and I hadn't really picked up on this before, his first scene gets a laugh. His very first scene is that scene with him saying, we must find that woman.
Oh, in the globe, yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
And that's such a good way of just getting the character over with the audience immediately. Very first time they've appeared on the screen, you're going to get a huge belly laugh.
The audience knows from the outset that this is who we're dealing with. In this, Clouseau is quite gracefully clumsy. I couldn't think of a better way of putting it. And you notice he walks almost like a pigeon when he's in and out of bed, you know, walking, hastening into the bathroom for the sleeping pills or whatever. Yeah. He's got a very distinctive little sort of waddle almost. It's lovely. I just want to mention an actor here called Michael Trubshaw.
Hmm.
Do you know about Michael Trubshaw?
He's somebody who's quite recognisable, isn't he?
He's got the very large moustache.
Yes.
And he plays a minor character in this. He's one of, because you have Brenda De Banzi as Angela Danning. Now, Brenda De Banzi, we've seen in films like, you and I have watched Hobson's Choice.
Mm-hmm.
She's been in The Man Who Knew Too Much with Bernard Miles as her husband. One of those faces that you would see in a lot of British films around this time. And she plays this this socialite who's always throwing these extravagant parties.
Yes.
And among her sort of, what would you call it, her entourage,
yeah,
if you like, is this character called Felix Towns. And he doesn't really have anything to do in the film. But what I thought was interesting, what I picked up on, because I wasn't really aware of the actor, but I noticed his name in the credits, Michael Trubshaw, and I thought, I wonder if it is. I wonder if that's the same guy. And I looked it up, and yes, it was. Because Trubshaw had been very, very close friends with David Niven in real life. He'd served with him at Malta and Dover in their early days. He'd been David Niven's best man twice. And Niven constantly refers to Trubshaw in The Moon's a Balloon. And I just want to read you this, because Niven describes first encountering Michael Trubshaw while they were both stationed in Malta. I guess it must have been in the, I'm not sure, late 20s, early 30s maybe. And he says, suddenly an ear-splitting belch rent the air. This is Niven. Yeah, I spun around and perceived a truly amazing sight. Trubshaw was approaching, 6 foot 6 with legs that seemed to start at the navel, encased in drainpipe-tight white flannels. He sported a blue blazer with so many brass buttons on it that he shone like a gypsy caravan on Derby Day. On his head, a Panama hat with MCC ribbon, of course. On his face, the biggest moustache I'd ever seen. A really huge growth, which one could see from the back on a clear day. Part of it was trained to branch off and join the hair above his ears. It was, in fact, not so much a moustache as an almost total hirsute immersion. Okay. Now, so as I say, the two of them had been very good friends, and I knew this fact that because it occurs in A Matter of Life and Death, for example. David Niven always tried to include his friend's name in every film he made. Okay, so in A Matter of Life and Death, Robert Coote's character is named Bob Trubshaw.
Flying Officer Trubshaw.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
You can't wait here any longer. You must be mistaken about your captain.
Well, if anyone's mistaken, it's not me.
Mistakes don't happen here.
But this is the aircrew section, isn't it?
You should know.
Peter couldn't have got away with it. Besides, you checked his invoice for me, didn't you?
Yes. It was against the regulations.
Regulations are made to be broken. He was due here half an hour after me. This is his section, and he hasn't reported. So he's either AWOL or there's been a mistake.
There hasn't been a mistake here for 1,000 years.
Oh, so there have been mistakes.
The girl that was here before me, she was here 640 years.
Holy smoke!
She said when the records don't balance, all the alarm bells start ringing in the records office.
I bet they do. Proper flap, eh?
Yes.
During the filming of Wuthering Heights, David Niven was in that, and he tried to convince the director, William Wyler, He tried to let him drop the name of Trubshaw into a line of dialogue, Wuthering Heights, and William Wyler refused. So Niven got around it by having a prop man add Trubshaw's name to a tombstone that we see in the graveyard. Okay. So he was, you know, it was his way of sort of honouring his friend by including Trubshaw's name in as many films as he could.
Yeah.
And then... I mean, up to this point, Trubshaw wasn't an actor. He'd been running a pub. And then he kind of just got into acting and fell into acting. And he was in films like, not huge roles, but Hard Day's Night, The Sandwich Man with Michael Benteen, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Magic Christian, Sellers, Bedazzled, Guns of Navarone, which Niven also was in. He was in a film called Operation Snatch, which sounds like... Sounds like something you'd watch.
Yeah, I was going to say it. If you hadn't said it, I was going to say it. It's probably on Amazon Prime.
but apparently him and Niven's relationship cooled, and Trubshaw insinuated in an interview that Niven sort of resented the fact that he'd followed him into acting. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So anyway. A big diversion there, but I just wanted to mention it because I was very interested in the Niven-Trubshaw relationship.
Quick deviation.
Yeah.
I do like going through newspaper archives. That's a big hobby of mine.
Yeah.
And there's so many of them online these days because, you know, there's just, over the last few years, there's been an explosion in the number of digitized newspaper archives that you can browse through. Previously, you had to actually go to the library, you know,
yes,
get a microfilm and what have you. So I was interested to know what the earliest usage of the phrase the Pink Panther was.
Mm.
And I ended up down a couple of little alleyways. Well, one of them actually was relatively recent. The fact that there is apparently a new leopard subspecies in South Africa, which was photographed at, I think it's pronounced, the Madikwe Game Reserve in April 2012. Mm-hmm. And it's been given this name, the Pink Panther. And it's described as a pink-hued male leopard. And it's not particularly pink when you see a photograph of it. But, so there we are. So there is actually a creature out there called the Pink Panther, for one thing. The earliest entry that I actually found for just the phrase itself was in 1907, And usually in the early part of the 20th century, it was being used in a whimsical manner, in the same way you would say, you know, you've seen, like, you know, pigs will fly, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you just see it used in poems and cartoons and so on. And then I saw an advert in a newspaper from New York, the Dunkirk Evening Observer, from July 1936, that was advertising a nightclub which was called Johnny Hammernick's. And from the description, it sounds like the kind of place that Stan and Ollie would have found themselves in Blotto, for example.
Yeah.
And they mention the Friday special at the bar is the Pink Panther.
Oh, wow.
Now, this then led me to research, okay, what actually is a Pink Panther? And apparently, this is according to a website, allrecipes.com, Pink Panther is a nice drink to have around the pool on hot summer days, and it consists of crushed ice, 1 fluid ounce of amaretto liquor, 1 fluid ounce of vodka, 8 fluid ounces of pineapple juice, 1 teaspoon of grenadine syrup, a freshly sliced pineapple, and 1 maraschino cherry. And actually gives you the directions as to how to assemble this in the glass.
Not as nice as an Esther Ranson.
Well, and that, do you know what? When I was reading this earlier on, straight away, I was just, all in my head was Pernod, Ouzo, marmalade and salt. And I'm thinking, which one is going to be better? So at some point, we'll have to do a taste test and see which one wins. Yes. And then this is the one that really struck me. And I thought, wow. In the Detroit Free Press, December 1946, there is a columnist who's talking about having found in an old jacket, he's found a business card for a chap called Little Joe. It says, call Little Joe for prompt service. Little Joe apparently was a bootlegger. Oh. And this business card was from the days of Prohibition. And it was basically a sort of liquor delivery service. You just ring this number and then somebody will come deliver your requested item. And he had a little price list on the card of all the bits and pieces that you could get. But the thing that really astonished me was that there was this phrase, Pink Panther, being used in a completely different context. The article said, the patrons of Little Joe would study the list, hoping to select some potion Little Joe had whipped up in his bathtub that wouldn't bring on pink panthers. And here it was being used in the way that we would now say pink elephants.
Ah, right. Yeah.
And I've never heard this before. And yeah, that was quite astounding. So I'd be interested to know what, if any of those was the trigger for actually titling the diamond and the film The Pink Panther, but it would be fascinating to know.
Absolutely.
If either of the writers had ever encountered those before.
Quite possibly. Just on the Pink Panther, the Pink Panther theme, the music, of course, is I'm going to say it, iconic. I hate to say iconic, but what other word is there?
Yes.
I'm sick of it. I've heard it so many times. You know, I used to love the Pink Panther theme, but it's become dulled by repetition, I suppose. But the music in this film is generally lovely, and particularly we've got halfway through the film this scene set around a fireplace in a ski lodge, and you've got the actress Fran Jeffries breaking the fourth wall and singing, singing a song, Meglio Stastera or something like that. I'm not quite sure. And wouldn't Gary, I mean, obviously, you know, I touched on this right at the outset, top of the show, but wouldn't you love to be in that locale?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. I really like that. I mean, I know that some people might sort of look at that and think, oh, that doesn't need to be there, that's slowing the plot down, whatever, but I really like that little intermission. And the fact that it's not just, because obviously a lot of different films some of the later Lauren Hardy films, for example, quite often have musical numbers in them that, that don't really serve any purpose in terms of the plot, per se. But this, initially, it starts off where you think, okay, not musical interlude. And then as the camera pans over, you can see Clouseau in animated conversation with Tucker. Yeah. And only Clouseau was animated. Tucker was quite impassive. But yeah, well, whatever it is that Clouseau was saying...
Clouseau's pissed off about something, isn't he?
Yeah, he's trying to sort of expound his theory about something and then just finds himself being wrapped up all of a sudden in this huge conga line.
And the best bit of that, right at the end when the music ends... Sellers decides just to inject this little bit of this like a little instinctive shoulder twitch thing, doesn't he? Right at the closure of the song.
Yes.
And he looks absolutely delighted. He's beaming, isn't he?
Yeah.
Which I thought was lovely. Okay, we haven't really touched. I think the third act is the best. I actually think we've got the fancy dress ball, which culminates in the car chase, and then the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that this is the best part of the film, strongest part. Yes. The police dressed, two policemen dressed as a zebra. I'll have your stripes.
Anything suspicious?
No, nothing to worry about. My men are everywhere, mingling here, mingling there, watching all the time, watching.
How dare you drink while you're on duty? Who is inside there?
Sergeant Wilder!
Sergeant Quiet!
Any more behavior like this and I'll have your stripes. And get out of here and start mingling again.
Quite funny, that zebra and stripes.
They're good. Well, I think I'll mingle.
Even the two men in gorilla suits doing a duck soup routine was very well done. And I'm not sure that's Robert Wagner in that gorilla suit. I don't think he's got the comedy timing.
No. I mean, presumably it wouldn't have been either.
No.
Wagner or Niven.
No. Yeah. And it's a bit of a weird, you know, the British ambassador who was also wearing a gorilla suit. Oh no, he was wearing a gorilla suit originally, and then David Niven knocked him out, I think. And
right, okay, now I did make a note of this because
yeah.
I thought that this was one area where Sir Charles, as his nephew discovers when he finds his case and then finds the false bottom in it, and he's got like all of his tools and so on. He's very precise about his work, but he's attending what he knows is a fancy dress do, and he attends it as a thief with the whole, like, you know, he's got the eye mask on and what have you. And I'm thinking, well, any other costume would have probably, you know, been a better disguise.
That's like,
he might as well
like,
have had the big bag with swag on it as well.
That's like one of those, you know, those Nazis that buggered off to Argentina after the war. That's like them turning up to a fancy dress party in 1971 dressed as Hitler.
You know, they're obviously thinking, nobody's going to suspect me.
And
think
also,
about it, Ted. Where's the last place you'd think I'd put them?
I was just also... Right, I know why they did it, but you've got two men in gorilla suits trying to open a safe.
Yes.
Why do they just take the heads off? Why do they have the heads on? I know why, because it's not Robert Wagner and probably not David Niven in there doing that comedy business, but still.
Maybe they both suspect that the other gorilla is undercover Clouseau. And they don't want to reveal themselves.
Or a real gorilla.
It could be, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the car chase with the old man crossing the square.
Now, okay, I've got a silly theory about this, which I cannot prove, but if anybody can prove this, I think it would be yourself. Okay, because you remember the tale about when Strangelove came out.
Yeah.
And the intended ending
for
Strangelove.
Yeah.
And how Sellers then, sort of in desperation, phoned Milligan and said, what do I do? How do we end this film? And it was Milligan that suggested Vera Lynn and We'll Meet Again.
Yes.
this whole scene with the car chase, it really strikes me as this is pure Spike Milligan. And I do wonder, okay, I know that it must have obviously have been in the text initially, but there's just something about this where I can sense that Milligan has played some sort of small part in suggesting little details. It might not even be like the entire scene, but things like, for example, the conversation between Clouseau and Tucker with the guy standing between them, and then Zebra running down the road. It just feels so
Milligan-ish. Absolutely. And also, I mean, it's great. Obviously, it would have been expensive to film an actual car crash. But again, the car crash happens off camera.
Yes.
And we just see the result of it. And the old man has just taken it all in a stride, isn't he? It's just another evening for him. The ending. We've talked about this in a previous podcast, not connected to Goonpod, but where, you know, there was a time in films where the villains could not profit at the end.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're kind of doing this, don't they?
Okay, now, I did wonder about this because I was thinking, okay, is this actually breaking the rule? I mean, the things that were popping into my head were, like, the last scene. I know this is a terrible spoiler. If you've never seen The League of Gentlemen, I mean,
brilliant film,
as in Richard Attenborough. Yeah. If you've never seen it, please just skip. With your permission, Tyler, because it's your cast, I'm going to suggest people just skip forward maybe 10 seconds or so now. Okay, right. The last scene in The League of Gentlemen is just underlining crime does not pay.
Yes.
Right? That's why it's there, yeah? And then I got to thinking, technically, if you want to be really precise about it, suppose Charles and Simone and his nephew and so on, they haven't, in this specific instance, apart from kidnapping the dog, he hasn't actually committed a crime, has he?
No.
Because he was obviously intended to, but...
No, true.
I mean, that in itself, the intention to steal the diamond should have been enough to get him in, you know, in chains, but nonetheless, you could sort of say, it's not like he's then legging it with the diamond, and also the princess, of course, for her own reasons, is also in her own way guilty as well.
Mm.
So
yeah,
it's sad, the conclusion, and it would have actually been, if things had worked out differently, and this had been the first in a series of films about Sir Charles starring David Niven, then it would have been quite a tragic ending for Clouseau. Even with the little point in there about, oh, they'll realise in a few months and he'll get out.
Yeah.
But
Clouseau is a national hero.
Mm-hmm.
He's got women throwing themselves at him as he's being led into the police car.
Yeah.
He's for the first time, he's a winner almost.
Yes.
And he can't quite get his head around that, so...
Could this have actually sent Clouseau in a completely different direction? When he got out eventually, could he have thought to himself, maybe I've been wrong on this whole, you know, police/villain. Maybe I've been on the wrong side of this all this time. Maybe I should try and become the next Sir Charles. Although I don't necessarily think that he would have had it in him as a professional.
No.
Jewel thief, safe cracker, whatever it is. I think that he probably would have, because he's not the most practical of people.
He would have been the one who would have employed John Bluthal to be lookout.
Yeah.
although, hang on, John Bluthal's character wasn't actually blind, was he?
No, he wasn't. No, no, indeed. A couple of little lines that stood out. One was, I just love that little scene where he's racing off to catch Sir Charles, and he's got the gun in his hand and he shouts, "I've really got him this time." that's just a lovely little flourish where he's suddenly, you know, he's alive. He's just like, right, this is my life's work. I'm actually going to get him at last. That recurring line that he's got, he uses about three or four times. It's hell in here.
Oh, yeah. You know where that's from.
Now, okay, now, because you know, of course, that I'm not a Gunshow aficionado, so is this a Gun reference?
It must be hell in there, or variations of that line he uses in this film, and that's a blood knock line from the Goons.
Right.
Hello, my darling.
Hello, my darling. Why did you draw the curtain?
Oh, just to keep me warm.
Warm?
Mm-hmm.
Warm is one thing. It must be hell in there.
No, it's wonderful.
And the one other one as well, there's almost certainly no connection at all with this. But when I heard it, I couldn't help but thinking, is this possibly a nod to this? When he's at the party and in the chaos when the lights are out, the woman with her snake, she says to him, take your filthy hands off my asp.
Mm.
That got me thinking about the Peter Cook routine, which also Kenneth Williams did as well.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I've got an asp in here. And I don't know, is that just nonsense? Is that just something that pops into my head at random, or is that something that the sellers heard? I mean, I'm probably going to find out now. Probably somebody's going to point out that sketch actually came after the Pink Panther or something, but... It struck me as maybe that was just a little nod.
Maybe.
Because, yeah.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. I said the villains kind of win, but it's a kind of a grey area. Mm-hmm. Who are we rooting for in this film? Who are we meant to be rooting for? Is it the thief and the philanderer, Charles Lytton? Is it the adulteress, Simone Clouseau? Is it the fraudulent womanizing George Lytton? Is it the entitled princess? Who, by the way, wants to stop the diamond, the Pink Panther diamond, being returned, rightfully returned, to her people in Lugash?
Hmm.
Are we meant to root for any of those characters, or are we meant to root for Clouseau? I'm not quite sure.
It's a tricky one, because, I mean, I think certainly Clouseau is the only one who comes out of this with any integrity out of all those characters. And yet, you're probably sort of thinking in a way, is Sir Charles going to pull it off? Is he actually going to, you know, get on a ski lift with the diamond intact and go on to his next escapade?
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a tricky one. I mean, I'm a big fan of, like, heist films and so on. And there were... You remember that a few years ago, there were at least three that I know of, possibly more, dramatizations of the Hatton Garden heist.
Oh, yeah.
And the one I really like was the television dramatization with Kenneth Branagh. But there was also another one with Michael Caine as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw a review of that one which was suggesting that they didn't focus enough on the victims in that case, because it was all just about the hijinks of this, you know, group of, you know,
mm-hmm.
Would-be villains. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but when you get caught up in that kind of plot, you're sort of thinking to yourself, you know, can they do it? Can they pull it off? I don't think that most people are looking at that kind of film and thinking, God, I hope the police hurry up and turn up, you know.
True. No, you do want them to succeed, don't you? Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a tricky one, and yeah,
But I suppose the point I'm trying to make is that, I say, who are we rooting for? Clouseau is the standout character. Mm-hmm. The others, with the possible exception of Simone Clouseau or Capucine, the others are fairly vanilla, aren't they, really?
Mm-hmm.
David Niven's no great shakes. His character is just fairly bland. Robert Wagner's just annoying. And to a degree, so is the princess.
I would have been interested. I mean, okay, the film is, as I was saying before, it felt a little bit too long, so I don't think there would have been any additional space for this, but I would have been interested actually in some sort of spin-off that actually told Sir Charles' tale about how he got into this at first, because he, from what we understand, he has got this respectable veneer, and that's a common enough text common enough plot in many texts about the respectable businessman. Do you know who this person is? You know who you're talking about. You can't just go pointing the finger at them. You know?
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I'm interested to know, did he become, was he always a straight businessman who then got into trouble and then started this sideline, or was it the other way around? He always needs a sort of a respectable occupation to be able to, because he can't introduce himself as, you know, I'm a safecracker, and the reason I'm here is because I've got an eye on what you've got in your safe upstairs.
Well, he's clearly got a lot of money, because he's got, you look at the drinks cabinet that he had in his hotel room, which was the size of a studio flat in London.
Really? Oh, but I know, I mean, this was the 60s after all, and yeah. I mean, everybody in film and on television in the 60s and 70s drank to excess and had ridiculously large bars. I mean, Christ, Terry Medford even had a whole bloody cocktail cabinet. I mean, he can't have been on Sir Charles' money, surely.
I think Sir Charles doesn't need the money at all. I think he's just in it for the thrill of it. I think that's all it is.
A couple of last little tangents for myself.
Sure.
One thing that I was a little bit surprised about, because I didn't think that this was going to tie into the timeline, but when I was looking at the newspaper articles about the Pink Panther getting its release, I think it was in January 64, I got its British premiere release.
Yeah.
And quite quickly on the heels of that, in February 64, were all the stories about Peter Sellers and Britt Eklund. And I'm sure you've touched on that in the cast previously, but one thing that was intriguing was the case of Mr. Sven Eklund, Britt Eklund's father.
Oh, yes.
And the case of, when did he see the Pink Panther? Because in the course of all these articles about the fact that, you know, Sellers and Eklund were going to marry within the space of 3 weeks or so, there were quotations from Britt Eklund's parents. And one of them in particular was in the Western Daily Press on the 12th of February, 1964, when Sven Eklund said, "I have never seen Peter Sellers in films." And yet, the Daily Herald for the 12th of February, 1964, has Mr. Sven Eklund quoted as saying, "Having seen Peter Sellers in The Pink Panther, he seems a very pleasant sort of man." Now, are we to deduce from this that Sven got a phone call from the Western Daily Press and said, "Peter Sellers, no, can't place him. Don't think I've ever seen him." Then consults the newspaper listings, spots that the Pink Panther is in, because I'm sure one of these articles actually said that he lived on a street with a cinema. So just then goes straight to the cinema, goes to the first screening of the Pink Panther, gets back just in time for a phone call from the Daily Herald, and said, "Yeah, I'm glad you called, because I've actually just been watching him, and lovely chap." So. The other thing I really liked was a review in the Liverpool Daily Post. I'm not sure if it was exclusive to that publication or if it was a syndicated column, but it's a reviewer called John Chesterfield. And about Clouseau, he wrote, "A funny, pathetic character emerges as genuine as Chaplin's," which I really liked.
Yeah.
And for that to be identified right off from the first film is, absolutely, I guess that's that puts the full stop on the fact that it was still being billed, and it's obviously still is, as David Niven and Peter Sellers. But there's no question that, you know, just from the first viewing alone, that Clouseau is the standout character of this.
Yeah, and I think it's still a pretty decent film, and Sellers is brilliant in every scene that he's in.
Yes.
And yeah, there's some longueurs, there's some fairly strung out bits that we could do without, and we could have certainly done without Robert Wagner, I think, but I would suggest that this film is one of those films that's probably caused a lot of disappointment over the years to people, you know, renting it out on video. Mm-hmm. Things like that, thinking that it's the knockabout slapstick Clouseau Pink Panther films that we get in the 70s, only to find that it's a fairly straightforward international romp with some glitzy locations and some beautiful woman and, you know, a big name star in the official starring role, but with the Clouseau character in it for maybe, I don't know, half the film? Is he mm-hmm. maybe 2/3 of the film we see Clouseau? Yep. Something yes. like that.
Yeah.
And he's certainly not the Clouseau. I mean, in many ways he is, but he's not, as I said before, he's certainly not as cartoonish as he is to become.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the film itself is not as cartoonish, because you look at Strikes Again, for God's sake. That whole film is basically, it builds to a cartoonish crescendo.
And it is amazing that Dreyfuss actually returns to the police department.
Yeah.
As a result of you can draw a line between return and revenge. I think you can get away with that. But Strikes Again is somewhat more difficult to square. I would say if you were planning on watching like the whole Clouseau box set, I wouldn't skip this. I mean certainly set your expectations for 1960s, think of a Lou Grade production, you know, it like The Seine or The Persuaders or something like that. Yeah. It's going to be, you know, exotic locations and very colourful and so on. Think of that. But I certainly wouldn't skip it. I wouldn't go straight to the 70s, because it is really fascinating to see the development of Clouseau.
Yeah.
And... yeah, so the other thing as well is it is odd just how fully formed, almost, Clouseau is by Shot in the Dark, because then you've got everybody else around him. You've mm-hmm. got all the regular supporting players in that film. And, okay, the last thing that's popping into my head is, how many Pink Panther films actually involve the Pink Panther diamond?
Two?
I don't have an answer to this. I'm going to have to think of this.
Two?
Okay. Shot in the Dark doesn't.
No.
Return does. Strikes Again doesn't. Revenge doesn't. Not including Trailer Curse. So it is. It's two, isn't it?
Two.
Yes. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah. By the time... okay. Return of the Pink Panther addresses it. The Pink Panther diamond is, of course, involved in the plot. But after that, it's just the Pink Panther's just shorthand for... yes. Clouseau. It's another Clouseau film.
Here's a theory, okay? I don't think that Christopher Plummer as Sir Charles Lytton, I don't think he's a real Sir Charles Lytton. I think he's another jewel thief going by the name Sir Charles Lytton.
Ah, trading on his notoriety.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Because Charles is either retired or is in jail or whatever, and then he's appropriated his image, and it's a case of identity theft.
Or he's got the real Sir Charles locked up in a cellar.
Possibly so, yeah.
Don't know why he would do that, but anyway.
Right, and quick trivia question for you. What is Dave Lodge's character name in Return?
He's only referred to by his surname, isn't he?
I think so, yes.
Well, you don't know either.
Well, no, I'm looking at it because I'm staring at IMDb.
Go on, what's the name?
His name is Mac.
Oh, right.
Yes. Well, they should have given them the same name as he's got in Coco Show Heroes. Although the continuity would have been a bit off.
I'd have liked in Return of the Pink Panther if at some point he flexes his muscle. Yeah, as Clouseau's dicking about with the telephone or something.
Should Dave Lodge have been allowed to break the fourth wall and deliver his famous line?
There we go. So, happy 60th birthday, the Pink Panther. I don't know whether ITV will be marking the occasion by screening it again in prime time.
I don't believe there are any plans to do so.
Well, you've got a bit of influence, Gary. Surely you could have put the word
on. I have no influence. I have awareness of what may be on ever so slightly ahead of the Radio Times, but no. Right. I can't just... yeah, unfortunately, I cannot actually stage Clouseau season on ITV1. Whenever I fancy it.
But right after we stop recording, I'm going to be pressing you for all the goss about Nigel in the jungle, of course, because you know everything, don't you?
Oh, why? Yes, yeah, absolutely.
All the dirt.
Yeah.
Gary, listen...
that's going to sound such a dated reference by the time this drops.
True. It'll be out by then, probably. So hopefully, as you referred to right at the top of the show, hopefully there'll be a pre-Christmas or a Christmas sitcom club.
Fingers crossed. I actually had a rumour that you might be on it yourself.
Oh, I'd be very pleased to add my two penneth. All depends on logistics, of course, doesn't it? Really?
Yes. Yeah.
So we will see. And this podcast will be taking a break in January for maybe a couple of months. And after that, I'd love to get you back at some point, maybe next year or some. Well, no, you are going to come back next year because at some point we're going to talk about the Man About the House movie, aren't we?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
And the reason we will be talking about that on Goonpod is because, of course, Spike has a memorable cameo.
Indeed.
So, but you and I are both huge fans of the television show, aren't we? So,
yes.
Lots to talk about there. So, look forward to that. So, Gary, thank you so much. And thank I'll, you. I'd normally say to guests, I'll talk to you again in the future. I will talk to you again tomorrow, I think.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Cheers, mate. Thanks very much.
Cheers, mate. Bye bye.